and you demand, on the basis of the Euratom directive, you demand that they reassess their radiation risk models because of the new information that's come out as a result of Chernobyl after 1996. And of course, they will say no, but that's good. But that's because we want them to say no. Because as soon as they say no, and I hope you're listening, we will go around them to the European Court of Human Rights. Now, in the European Court of Human Rights, we will be dealing with philosophers and judges, and not with physicists. And in any domain where we deal with philosophers and judges, we will win. There is no question. Because our cause is just, and because everything that we say is true, and because the logic is absolutely irrefutable. Okay, the main point about this question is, why epidemiology? Well, the reason we have to do epidemiology is that we cannot get the statistical data from the cancer registries, because they keep it secret. Since 1991, the cancer registries in Europe have said that they are not going to give any data out on cancer rates in small areas near nuclear power stations. And so we are on a spaceship flying through space with no instruments that tell us whether people are getting sick or not. Because all of the instruments that tell us whether people are getting sick from cancer or not, which is caused by radiation, are all covered over with silver paper. They don't allow us to see the data. So the point is, we can do our own epidemiological studies, and that's basically what I'm talking about here. In 1991, there was a big war in Iraq, and after that, when a lot of uranium weapons were used, lots of people started to get cancer, lots of people started to die, children were born with congenital malformations, but it wasn't until 2010 that anybody did any epidemiology, because none of the authorities would allow any of the data out, and nobody would do any of the epidemiological studies. Now, the punchline here, since I don't want to upset the chair, is that it's not difficult to do these studies. These studies are, everybody is told that they can't do these studies because they're not really epidemiologists. But actually, this isn't true. Anybody can do these studies. You go and you knock on doors and you ask people how many people there have got cancer. And in fact, one of the first studies that was done in epidemiology by the father of epidemiology, John Snow, was done in exactly that way. He went around London knocking on doors and said how many people had cholera. And he was able to establish that the cause of cholera was a particular contaminated water supply. And he was not an epidemiologist, because at that time it didn't exist. Of course, nobody believed him, and he died quite young. But now we know that he was the beginning of the science of epidemiology. There are various types of citizen studies, and I'll show you the results of some of the ones that we've done. We looked at breast cancer mortality in wards near a nuclear power station in Essex, and you can see here that the high levels of breast cancer are close to the nuclear power station and close to the mud, which is contaminated by the releases from the nuclear power station. And here's another study that I did with people in the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, and that was about contamination of the coasts near Carlingford, which is a town on the coast on the Irish Sea, contaminated by Sellafield. So a lot of the material from Sellafield gets into the mud, and those red circles are individual cases of cancer, and you can see that the cancer rates are all very close to the sea where the mud is contaminated. And then this graph in the bottom corner, you can see how the rates fall down as you go away from the sea, and those are distances in meters, incidentally. And these are caused by the sea spray producing the particles of radioactivity, mostly plutonium, I have to say, in the air, and then it gets inhaled. And these sorts of studies are done merely by knocking on doors and asking people questions. We've done about 6 or 7 questionnaire studies, and this talk of mine shows you exactly how to do all of this. It's really very simple. You have to ask how many people live there and what their ages are and so forth, and you put all this down and you do a little bit of simple arithmetic, and eventually you come out with the results that tells you whether the cancer is greater or less than it should be. And one of the most famous ones that I did was the one of a nuclear power station in Wales, which was done with a TV company, and it was the TV people who knocked on doors, and they went around with a camera interviewing the people that they talked to. And this shows you the age breakdown of the population that they talked to. and here's the nuclear power station, there's a circle there. And the town that we're talking about was at Llanfestiniog, which is up in the top right-hand corner there. And we got huge increases in cancer in those people who were downwind. So what I need to say to conclude is that you can do these things yourself, or at least, and particularly in Japan, what I suggest is that around Fukushima, that they very much certainly do these things themselves, because otherwise they're never going to find out what's going on. And I have actually translated the Fukushima questionnaire into Japanese, so that this questionnaire is available in Japanese, and I would hope that some groups in Japan use this to find out what the levels of cancer are there. And although I invented this method in 1999, it was reinvented by some people in an epidemiological journal. And then, of course, when you find these things, you can go straight to the media, who are always very interested, and they will always publish what you find. Okay, you need a few computer programs, and there are various other types of studies that you can carry out. Now, if anybody wants to do these studies or wants to know more about this type of approach, then contact Green Audit, contact myself or Ditto over there, and we will help you as much as we can. We know how to do it, and we can easily pass that knowledge on. If you don't require a degree in mathematics, all you require is a little bit of nerve and a decision to do it. And remember, we are at the center of our world, and if we want to know what is happening, we have to look out of the window and think for ourselves. The European Committee on Radiation Risk, who I represent as scientific secretary, have developed a risk model which will tell you how many people will die following any exposure from various diseases, certainly from cancer. And this has been shown to be the case by a study in Sweden of the effects of Chernobyl, where this risk model predicted exactly what they found. And what it shows is that the risk model of the ICRP is wrong by a factor of approximately 400 times. So if the ICRP risk model says that you're going to get one cancer after a certain exposure, that is to say in a particular population, actually you'll get 400. And you need this, and it might sound insane, but you need this kind of level in order to explain the results, the epidemiological results. But if we want to know what's happening, we have to look at epidemiology.
Now, if you thought Chris Busby's faith in the integrity of the judicial process rather naive, then you're not alone. I find it interesting that believing what he believes about the dangers of nuclear radiation, the fact that it might be 400 times as dangerous as the powers that be let on, given that, it is interesting that he suspects that writing letters will make much difference in the scheme of things. My analysis goes that the people making the decisions are more or less sociopathic, so appealing to their good nature is not going to be an effective way of changing things. I think a large number of people physically manifesting at a nuclear power station and taking the appropriate steps to shut it down is a lot more likely as a trigger than shifting a few papers around offices. Never mind internet petitions. Now we're going to look at the other side of the nuclear weapons program, looking at the effects on the participants. This is an interview by Raising Sand Radio from May 2012.
This year, on August 6th and 9th, the world remembers the first ever use of atomic bombs on civilian populations during war. 67 years ago, the U.S. dropped Little Boy on Hiroshima via the Boeing B-29 Superfortress Enola Gay, piloted by Colonel Paul Tibbets of the 393rd Bombardment Squadron, Heavy of the United States Army Air Forces. This event was the second artificial nuclear explosion in history after the Trinity test and the first uranium-based detonation. Approximately 600 to 860 milligrams of matter in the bomb converted into an active energy of heat and radiation and exploded with an energy of 16 kilotons of TNT. It has been estimated that 130,000 to 150,000 people had died as a result of its use by the end of December 1945. Little Boy's design was not tested in advance, unlike Fat Man, the more complex plutonium bomb dropped 3 days later, August 9th, on Nagasaki. Within the first 2 to 4 months of the Nagasaki bombing, 60,000 to 80,000 people died, with roughly half of the deaths occurring on the first day. Following the end of World War II, popular culture in the U.S. ushered in the atomic era, with fashion and hairstyles and music cashing in on a trend. Today we'll hear some of the music of the atomic era and hear from M.T. Sylvia, producer and director of Atomic Mom, an 80-minute film that debuted in October 2010. I talked to M.T. Sylvia at her home in Oakland, California, just after the film debuted, and I've updated this show to re-air this week to remember the events in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, now 67 years ago. The film unfolds the story of M.T. Sylvia learning about the work of her mother, Pauline Sylvia, as a Navy biologist. Pauline Sylvia carried out research on the effects of radiation on mice and dogs at Hunter's Point in San Francisco. Pauline Sylvia was present also at the test sites in Nevada, and for years she never spoke with anyone about her work. This was standard practice with the military, and she had also been sworn to secrecy. But M.T. Sylvia, her daughter, was curious, and over time turned what had started off as recording a family history into this film. Atomic Mom includes travel to Hiroshima and interviews with Hibakusha, that's Japanese survivors of the blast in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also the pop culture surrounding the atomic age in Las Vegas, and her mother's journey into the past and her ongoing question about why, when the military knew how radiation affected human beings, it exposed military personnel to test blasts anyway. I talked to M.T. Sylvia at her home in Oakland, California.
As a kid, I knew that she had worked, quote, on the atom bomb, but I didn't know what it meant. And as a child, I thought she was some sort of spy or James Bond movie type of character, because she couldn't talk about it. She was sworn to secrecy. And I fantasized about what it was, but I really had no idea what the atom bomb was. Later on in my life, I became an anti-war activist in my teens and early 20s, and I started working with the anti-nuclear movement and realizing, hey, what did my mom do? I knew she did something, and we'd never really talked about it. But she came to visit me in San Francisco about 10 or 12 years ago, and we were driving north on 101, and when you look to the right of Candlestick Park, there is this tall white building with no windows in it. It's about 5 stories tall. And she said, oh, there's the Rad Lab. And I said, what? She said, that's the Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory. That's where I worked. And I just immediately started asking her all these questions, and that's how this whole story started.
As a quick aside, Hunter's Point, that M.T. Sylvia refers to, is Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard, notorious in the San Francisco Bay Area for dumping radioactive waste in barrels off the coast and scuttling a radioactive ship into the Pacific. Today, Hunter's Point is a series of highly toxic Superfund sites where Lennar Development Corporation plans to build residential housing. Meanwhile, the current residents of the low-income, ethnically diverse communities around Hunter's Point suffer physical ailments from asthma to cancers, and they are prohibited from eating any of the vegetables that they may grow in their small gardens. In the past, I've aired a number of shows about these communities, and listeners can do an online search on my name or Susan Gallimore Raising Sand Radio to listen to those shows. And let's not forget that our own Alameda Naval Air Station was very active during this time. Indeed, the U.S. Navy's aircraft carrier, USS Hornet, launched 16 U.S. Army Air Force B-25B Mitchell medium bombers deep into the western Pacific Ocean. The Doolittle Raid on April 18, 1942, was the first air raid by the United States to strike the Japanese home islands, specifically Honshu, during World War II. The plan called for the Doolittle Raid to bomb military targets in Japan and to continue westward to land in China. The raid was planned and led by Lieutenant Colonel James Jimmy Doolittle, U.S. Army Air Forces. Doolittle would later recount in his autobiography that the raid was intended to bolster American morale and to cause the Japanese to begin doubting their leadership. Today, Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle has a street named after him, and as most Alamedans know, the former naval base is undergoing remediation to transfer it from a Superfund site back to civilian use. Listen to my recent interview with Professor Paul Kaibel to understand more about one facet of this cleanup, that of the federal portion of the land. This was originally conceived of as open space. Now there is some question about that as the Navy fast-tracks the cleanup to enable the build of the large Veterans Administration complex. That show aired last week, and if you missed it, visit the News and Views page of Alameda Community Radio's website, which is also alamedacommunityradio.org, to listen to it. Let's return to M.T. Sylvia.
Later, I found out during her spiritual journey in the mid-90s is when she started looking back on her life and all the things that she had done, and she started really looking at this time in the military. She worked on this program for about 4 years. I'm really proud of her that she did, in this age of WikiLeaks and, you know, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, I think it's really important that people tell the truth about their experience, and so people get real information.
She is very honest about it.
Yeah, it's a struggle for her. She made an oath and a promise that she wouldn't tell these secrets, mm-hmm. and in the 50s, that was a really big deal. So it's been a lifelong process for her to give herself permission to talk about it.
That point where she talks with, is it Ray Harbert, mm-hmm. in the movie, mm-hmm. where you can see she's really feeling like it's okay to relax and talk to this man.
They have found a kindred spirit together because Ray had worked in the Bikini Islands and had strong feelings about what happened to the people on the island of Rongelap, which my mother did as well, because they would ship animals from Rongelap to San Francisco, Hunter's Point, and she would study the radiation effects. Mm-hmm. And so they really bonded on that, and they both felt the same about the Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, about how it really falls short on showing anything about the humanity, and it's so focused on the technology.
She was in an interesting situation in the 50s, right? Women didn't really get these kinds of jobs. And she talks in the movie about how she had to compartmentalize her brain.
Yeah, it was part of being in the military. And you know, she even talks about this in the film, where different branches of the military weren't talking to each other. So she was in the Navy while, you know, the Air Force was doing their own experiments, the Army was doing their own experiments, and nobody was really talking to each other, mm-hmm. which is why she was so confused that when they started putting soldiers in trenches out in the desert, you know, certain distances from ground zero, and detonating the bombs. Because it was, you know, all the research she was doing was showing about the effects of ionizing radiation and, you know, what radiation illness was, and she was doing this with animals, and at the same time, they were putting humans out there, soldiers in the trenches.
I asked M.T. Sylvia to describe her own process of discovery as the story unfolded.
You know, I really wanted to understand this part of my mother's life, and I had a real conflict about it. We were both on different pages around it, and I mean, she was very proud of her military service and what she did for this country, and I can appreciate that, and I have a respect for that, but I was also in a big conflict because I was so anti-war, and to think about her working on the development of the atom bombs. Now, she didn't specifically do that. She studied the effects of radiation from them, but it was a real conflict for me. So I just started asking her all these questions. I just let myself be open to hearing what she had to say. She came to visit me, and she brought a box of all of her Navy files, and we started going through it together, and I asked her if I could turn on a camera and film it, because it was just such an interesting story. I just wanted to record it for family history. That was my simple intention. I had no intention of making a documentary at that point. I just wanted to get it down on tape. I didn't want to miss any of it. And so I was really grateful that she let me do that, and it was here at this kitchen table, or dining room table, was the first time we did that. So I just kept asking her questions, and she was really honest with me, and then she went home back to Rhode Island, and I kept doing all this research on the Nevada test site, on the atomic testing program, on radiation survivors, on Hunter's Point. I actually went to Las Vegas for my job twice, and on one of those trips I took a tour of the Nevada test site, and I just really wanted to experience what she experienced and understand it. And during that trip, I called her and told her what I was doing and sent her all this information. I found 3 scientific papers that she had co-authored. And then I invited her to take the trip with me, and she wanted to go back to the test site herself. And I think it was part of her trying to find some resolution in her own heart and mind about the work that she had done. And so we did the trip together, and I wasn't allowed to take a camera with me, but it was a very emotional experience, and it was a very sacred kind of thing to experience with her. I went back to Las Vegas again, and they had opened this new museum of atomic testing, and I had really strong feelings about it because it was so technical and there was very little about the humanity and what happens to people and living things with this technology. And while I was there, I met this woman who knew about an oral history project at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And the test site workers, and a woman named Mary Pileski was doing it, and she gave me her card. And I emailed Mary, and Mary had done over 150 oral histories but had never talked to a woman scientist. And so she was very interested in talking with my mom. And so I talked my mom into coming back to Las Vegas one more time to do this oral history. And I told her I'd like to hire a professional film crew for this and really film it and have Mary interview my mother so that there'd be some distance between me and my mom. And so I hired two friends of mine, a camera person and a sound person, and we went to Las Vegas for a week. And that's where we met Ray Harbert and Sister Rosemary Lynch from Pachi Bene. And my mom got to talk to all these people for a week. And by the time she left, I think she was lighter and felt better about it.
MT Sylvia traveled to Hiroshima, and the film shows amazing and very troubling footage of the aftermath of dropping the bomb on that city.
My day job was going to send me to Japan, and I thought, well, I should go to the Hiroshima Peace Museum, and I wanted to go to Hiroshima. I was really motivated to go. And I emailed the museum and asked if I could have permission to film inside the museum, and they put me in touch with Tomoko Nishisaki from the Hiroshima Film Commission, and she got me carte blanche to film anywhere in the city of Hiroshima, in the Peace Park, at the train station. All the location fees were waived. She asked me if I wanted to interview Dr. Shintaro Hida, who at the time was in his early 90s, and he actually took the train from Tokyo to Hiroshima, which is about a 3.5-hour train ride, just to do this interview with me. And so she arranged all of that. I interviewed the director of the museum. She asked me if I wanted to interview a survivor, and I hadn't thought about that. I said, well, yeah, maybe. And she said, well, what kind of survivor do you want to interview? And I thought, what a weird question. It just made me really uncomfortable. Because I felt like I was shopping for a Hiroshima survivor. It felt really weird to me. I had a bunch of my journalist friends come over for dinner to teach me how to interview, because I had never interviewed before. And one of them suggested, why don't you try to find a mother with a daughter and make a parallel between you and your mom? And I thought, what a great idea. And so I emailed Tomoko, and so she found me Miss Okada and her daughter. And so by the time I got to Hiroshima, I had 3 days of shooting all lined up with all these interviews. And it just snowballed and evolved kind of organically. So the whole story went in a completely different direction.
What's touching in the movie also is Miss Okada, who also says that she never really talked about her feelings about it. She always talked about it as a peace campaign or as an anti-nuclear campaign.
Yeah, and her daughter had never spoken about it for many years, and there was such a parallel between my mom and I. And when I interviewed them together, I asked them, you know, have you talked about it over all the years? And Miss Okada looked at her daughter and said, I don't think we've ever talked about it. I know that it started a dialogue for them, just being part of this film and talking about it.
Which is what I think the film is going to do overall.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now with the catastrophe in Japan, all of this is up again.
Yeah, it's really timely. I mean, the fact is we're all downwind of this story, and we have been for many, many years. And we continue to be.
Yeah, and we act again as if that's really not the case. We're going to continue to build nuclear power plants because we need the power.
Mm-hmm. We continue to put ourselves at risk.
Yes, we continue to put ourselves at risk, and much of the time we barely know it because the information we need is sketchy at best. Before we take a closer look at that, a reminder that I am Susan Gallimore, and this is Alameda Community Radio's News and Views, talking to MT Sylvia about her film Atomic Mom that debuted in 2010. This interview was recorded at that time, and I'm re-airing it to commemorate the 67th year since the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, August 6th and August 9th, respectively. Now, here is a clip from the 10-minute trailer for Atomic Mom with Pauline Sylvia, MT Sylvia's mother, talking about her work as a Navy biologist. You can view the trailer at atomicmom.org.
We would put the mice into these huge lead spheres at different areas around Ground Zero. And we would sit up all night until daybreak. That would be the time for the detonation. And we sat there on the hill and would link arms. We're told to put our heads down and not to look up. I thought, isn't this a hotshot thing? Am I going to have stories to tell about the fact that I saw an atomic detonation? How many people in the world see atomic detonations and have lived to tell it? I mean, that's what was going through my head. That's where my head was at that point.
But thinking about it today?
I should have been thinking about a lot of other things. I remember this sign that was going to be outside my office. The sign said Thermal Injury Branch.
That took us into a new project. And for that, we used dogs. We literally burned these dogs right down to the skin. And you begin to, I began to think about all of those things.
Meanwhile, 100 miles away in Las Vegas, people were not thinking about the potentially lethal effects being ushered in by the developing atomic age. In fact, Americans were generating a lot of excitement about atomic power in Las Vegas during the 50s and 60s. Those running the test sites worked together with those in the growing tourist and gambling industries in Las Vegas, where tourists partied all night, then went outside at dawn to watch bomb detonations. Fashion, beauty pageants, atomic bomb hairstyles, and music celebrated the atomic age. Here's Sheldon Ullman with Radioactive Mama.
Radioactive Mama, hold me tight. Radioactive Mama, treat me right. Radioactive Mama, we'll reach critical mass tonight. Get together, clear away the crowd. There won't be nothing left except a mushroom-shaped cloud. Radioactive Mama, treat me right. Radioactive Mama, we'll reach critical mass tonight. Well, your kisses do things to me in oh so many ways. I feel them going through me, all those gamma-gamma rays. Radioactive Mama, treat me right. Radioactive Mama, we'll reach critical mass tonight. Well, since I kissed you, baby, that evening in the park, I lost my hair and eyebrows and my teeth shine in the dark. Radioactive Mama, treat me right. Radioactive Mama, we'll reach critical mass tonight.
Before Before we return to MT Sylvia, producer and director of the film Atomic Mom, let's listen to another popular tune at the dawn of the atomic age, Sheldon Allman again with Crawl Out Through the Fallout.
Crawl out through the fallout, baby, when they drop that bomb. Crawl out through the fallout with the greatest of aplomb. When your white count's getting higher, hurry, don't delay. I'll hold you close and kiss those radiation burns away. Crawl out through the fallout, baby, to my loving arms, through the rain of strontium 90. Think about your hero when you're at ground zero, and crawl out through the fallout back to me. Crawl out through the fallout, baby, you know what I mean. Crawl out through the fallout, 'cause they said this bomb was clean. If you cannot find the way, just listen for my song. I'll love you all your life, although that may not be too long. Crawl out through the fallout, baby, to my loving arms, while those ICBMs keep us free. When you hear me call out, baby, kick the wall out and crawl out through the fallout back to me. 'Cause you'll be the only girl in the world. Why don't you crawl out through the fallout back to me? Why don't you crawl out through the fallout back to me? Why don't you crawl out through the fallout back to me?
That's Sheldon Allman with Crawl Out Through the Fallout, and here's Elton Britt's 1955 hit, Uranium Fever.
Well, I don't know, but I've been told uranium ore is worth more than gold. Sold my cad, I bought me a Jeep, I got that bug and I can't sleep.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down. Uranium fever is spreading all around.
With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to stake me some government land.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down.
Well, I had a talk with the AEC, and they brought out some maps that looked good to me. And one showed me a spot he said he knowed, so I straddled my Jeep and headed down the road. I reckon I drove about 100 miles down a bumpy road out through the wilds, when all of a sudden I bounced to a stop at the foot of a mountain, didn't have no top.
Uranium fever has done and got me down. Uranium fever is spreading all around.
With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to stake me some government land.
Uranium fever has done and got me down.
Well, I took my Geiger and I started to climb right up to the top, where I thought I'd find a hunk of rock that'd make it click, just like I'd read about Vernon Pitt. On the second day, I made the top, and I'm telling you, Steve, I was ready to stop. The only clicking that I heard that day was the bones in my back that had gone astray.
Uranium fever has done and got me down. Uranium fever, it's spreading all around.
With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to stake me some government land.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down.
Well, you pack up your things, you head out again into some unknown spot where nobody's been. You reach the spot where your fortune lies. You find it's been staked by 17 other guys. Well, I ain't kidding, I ain't gonna quit. That bug's done caught me and I've been bit. So with a Geiger counter and a pick in my hand, I'll keep right on staking that government land.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down. Uranium fever is spreading all around.
With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to stake me some government land.
Uranium fever has gone and got me down.
Elton Britt and Uranium Fever from 1955. Atomic Mom shows footage that many of us have never seen before, including American propaganda of the time, and then, as I mentioned earlier, stunningly painful footage from Japan.
I had found a photograph of Miss Atomic Bomb from a beauty pageant from 1957, and I wanted to get the rights to use that image in the film. So I went to the Las Vegas News Bureau, and there was this kid at the counter, and I said, "Do you have any moving footage of, you know, any film footage or anything?" And he said, "Oh yeah, come on in the back, I'll show you this tape." And he took me back and showed me the atomic hairdo, which you saw from the Flamingo Hotel. Women used to wear their hair shaped as mushroom clouds. And he showed me the footage of the marquee of Welcome Atomic Soldiers, and I said, "Oh, I have to have this." And I requested permission, and they denied me. They said they didn't want Las Vegas to be seen in a negative light.
This was congruent with not wanting atomic bombs to be seen in a negative light either. A press code, for example, had been in effect on what the public was allowed to know about the effects of the bombings in Japan.
The press code started directly after the bombings and wasn't lifted until 1952. So there were years of censorship. And what a lot of people don't realize and what comes out in the film is that the people in Japan were censored as well by the Japanese government as well. And where Dr. Heater couldn't talk to other doctors about radiation illness, and they couldn't report on their treatments they were doing at conferences, and it was really suppressed, all the information.
And yet they were seeing, at one point in the movie, he's talking about seeing up to 10,000 people a day, well, lined up for mm-hmm. care, and they had absolutely no idea what to do with these people.
Right, and they had no idea what they were treating. They didn't know what radiation illness was. And at first they thought they had an infection and that everyone was getting infected, which is why all these people were dying afterwards, especially people who weren't present at the bombing but came in immediately after to look for their loved ones and died 2 weeks later, you know, because of all the high levels of radiation. They thought they had an infection. And they were just desperate and helpless trying to figure out what to do. Even for years later, we're not allowed to report on any of their findings or talk to their colleagues about it.
And it actually has been very effective because, as we were talking about earlier, this kind of research, a lot of us just don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know something when we think we know more than we actually do know,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and the parallels today with what's happening in Japan, it's so timely. There's so much chaos around the information we're getting, and so much of it I don't trust, and even my friends in Hiroshima don't trust, or my friends in Japan. They're getting their information from places outside of Japan about what's happening. And I got an email from a friend in Hiroshima who said that she quoted the radiation weather forecast, which they were doing daily on the weather report, the radiation weather forecast. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to become a household word now. This is going to be common every night, like the smog alert. And Hiroshima was expecting the contamination to reach them in like in the next day or two. And when you think about the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who were mostly children and young adults when all of that happened, that are alive today and here in the second time in a lifetime, they have to see such a catastrophic disaster and experience it again in their toilet years. It just breaks my heart.
MT and her mother, Pauline Sylvia, still have a few differences. One of them is about Pauline Sylvia's health.
She doesn't want me to talk about what her specific health issues are, and I respect that, but this is where we're on a different page. You know, she doesn't think any of her illnesses are related to her exposure, and I find that hard to believe. And it's really hard to prove it, too.
Ray Harbert talks about the Marshall Islands and one of the bombings of Bikini that he witnessed. And that's when he thinks he got his skin cancer.
Yeah, and actually Ray passed away from bladder cancer. And it was about a year and a half after, 2 years after we filmed him in the movie. He thought his bladder cancer was directly related to his... I mean, he had been battling skin cancer for a long time, mm-hmm. but the bladder cancer came up pretty quickly. And that's very common in atomic vets. And the thing that's... my mother really struggled with it was what did they do with all of her research and why did she do the research when they already knew it about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Why did they have to do it again? And then knowing what we knew, why did they put all these soldiers out in the trenches at the test site and why did we expose you know, most of the United States to this radioactive fallout in the name of science. And I think it's why she participated in the movie, because she wanted people to know about what happened.
And what do you make of those Christians? Why did they?
You know, when they first did the bomb, the first bomb at Trinity in Los Alamos, they didn't know if the universe was going to catch on fire. And they still detonated that bomb. And I that boggles my mind. It's like, why would you take that kind of a risk just so you could know something, just so you could prove something scientifically? And, you know, at the time, there was so much anti-Japanese racism that was developed and enhanced just to justify dropping these bombs. They never would have dropped them in Germany, you know, and all that racism was really vital to them dropping these bombs. You know, it cost them billions of dollars to make these bombs, and they had, you know, the war was basically over, so Japan was losing, but they went ahead and to test them because they wanted to have this kind of power and might in the future. And the two bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one was a plutonium bomb and one was a uranium bomb. So there are people who might argue that the bomb in Hiroshima could be justified, but you cannot justify the bomb in Nagasaki. It was purely testing a different kind of technology. And most of the testing has been done on indigenous people's land. The Nevada test site is on Shoshone land. The Marshall Islanders, the native people in the Marshall Islanders, and the Aboriginals in Australia, you have to know about that as well, that these test sites were on people's lands, the indigenous people's lands, which is still horrific as well.
When you look at the footage of the desert in Nevada where the tests were carried out, can that land be turned back safely to people anyway?
No. I think some of the parts of the test site are still hot, and there's like football fields full of contaminated waste that's being stored there. The Marshall Islands, the people on Ranjalab, they were sent back to their island in the early 80s. And it was still hot, and Greenpeace came in 1985 and evacuated them again. But they've been put back there again to the island. They can't eat any of the vegetables on the island. And so they can only eat processed food that's brought in. So, I mean, it's completely destroyed their culture.
And again, Ray Harbert makes reference to concreting over one of the islands.
Yeah, in Aniwetok, they just covered in cement.
Which is kind of what they do here with the bases. I mean, we're talking about putting a cap on Alameda because it's so radioactive. Mm-hmm. They do it at Hunter's Point. It's like, cover it up, put a bit of sand on top, off you go.
Compartmentalize it.
wait a little while and then put a bunch of people on there to live on it because they won't actually know what happened.
Right, right. Yeah, I had a friend who was an acupuncturist on Hunter's Point in a clinic over there, and she saw so many high incidences of asthma, breast cancer, all kinds of cancers, you know, all kinds of symptoms.
How does M.T. Sylvia, producer and director of Atomic Mom, hope this movie makes a difference in our world?
Well, I think it's timely now because people feel at risk right now because of what's happened in Japan. And so I think people are wanting to know more about it and seeking out the information. And this is what Atomic Mom is for me. It's a prayer for a softer world. And for me, it started at the kitchen table with my mom just asking questions. And I think that's where we all have to start, is just to at least start talking about it instead of not talking about it and asking questions. And then once we know the answers to those questions, ask what the knowing asks of us. You know, I mean, we can't just sit by, and it's the apathy that keeps it going. The fact that we're still on hair trigger alert with thousands of nuclear weapons, 100 times bigger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, pointed at each other right now, is way more of an emergency than global warming, because in a matter of moments we can destroy the entire planet. And a lot of people don't realize we're still on hair trigger alert. They think the Cold War ended and that was over. And I think that's where we have to start, is to modify the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review, not just to reduce nuclear weapons, but to completely abolish them.
But we're not going to be doing that. Obama, in fact, just decided to replenish our arsenals.
Yeah, and the Hibakusha, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are so upset with him after his speech in Prague. It's shameful after what he said in Prague and what he promised them, and now we've turned around and doing something completely different. And they are outraged at him, and I am too.
Here is a clip of what Obama said in Prague.
As the only nuclear power to have used a nuclear weapon, the United States has a moral responsibility to act. We cannot succeed in this endeavor alone, but we can lead it. We can start it. So today, I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
That was President Obama in Prague in April 2009. Less than a year later, he budgeted over $80 million to replenish and renew our nuclear arsenal. What can you do? First, thank you to MT Sylvia for the documentary Atomic Mom. And go there to the website atomicmom.org to find out where you can watch this film and begin to learn as much as you can about this topic. Atomic Mom has won several awards, including the Gold Award for Best Feature Documentary, and that's at the Lake Arrowhead Film Festival, the Best Feature Documentary Jury Award at the 2011 Thin Line Film Festival, and the Silver Palm Award at the Mexico International Film Festival. Visit the website atomicmom.org to view the trailer or to find out where you can see the show, or if you want to contact producer and director MT Sylvia directly yourself. I talked to MT Sylvia this week on the phone. She reports that the movie has won 11 awards and continues to show across the country and around the world. Last December, it premiered in Hiroshima, and MT describes that event.
The audience, there were several survivors in the audience, and you know, I have a Japanese version of it, which I'm very proud of, that we had so that it was more accessible to the Japanese people. And I think the overwhelming feeling in Hiroshima is so much about peace and reconciliation and anti-nuclear activism. It was very well received at the film festival. I was on a couple of panels on women and peace. It created a great dialogue, but at the same time, it was in the shadow of Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And although a lot of it's related, it was really heart-wrenching to see the Hibakusha, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, experiencing another serious nuclear event in their lifetime. And that was, it saddened me quite a bit. You know, I met a lot of activists around the Fukushima event, and I met a woman who was running a program called the Sandbox Project, where she was going to all the playgrounds in Tokyo measuring radiation levels and finding, you know, very high levels, and, you know, creating a lot of activism around protecting people. And I learned a lot about, you know, relationships, having serious challenges where the women wanted to take their children out of Japan even, mm-hmm. or as far away from Fukushima, and the elders and the grandparents, and they don't want to move, they want to stay, and it really broke up a lot of families.
Wow. Prior to the screening of Atomic Mom last December, one of the characters from the film, Miss Okada, a survivor of the atom bomb in Hiroshima, went into the streets of Hiroshima to hand out flyers and to alert residents about the screening of Atomic Mom.
During the Q&A, Miss Okada's grandchildren came up and put a lei of origami peace cranes around my neck, which was really, really beautiful. There were a lot of children of survivors there who said that, you know, it really brought a lot of questions. Watching Atomic Mom made them want to ask their parents or questions about their experience that they, you know, stories they had never really heard.
Mm.
And it's really mixed. Some Hibakusha want to talk about it, and others don't want to talk about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very painful memory to bring up.
I asked M.T. Sylvia about her mother, Pauline Sylvia.
My mom is in, you know, assisted living, and, you know, her health is failing. She's aging, and some days she's more lucid than others, but I'm really glad I made the film when I did.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, it's been interesting, it's been complicated, her response to the film. I've sent her lots of letters and emails I get, you know, with very positive feedback about her participation and how much she's inspiring young students. You know, we did a screening at the University of Utah, and all of the students in the class wrote her a letter, and it was they were really beautiful. And, you know, the impact she's having, I don't think she really realizes it. Some students come up to me and say they've inspired to become anti-nuclear activists. Others are just, you know, really shocked to find out, you know, these secrets of the government from the atomic testing era. I think the thing that I'm really pleased with is the dialogue that happens, and it airs regularly on the documentary channel now, and several people have emailed me long emails with very thoughtful questions and really challenging themselves in the way they've been taught to believe. And it's just, you know, I had one Marine mom whose son really wanted to go fight in the Iraq war, and she was against it, and when he turned 18 he went, and she's been really struggling with American militarism. And, you know, she emailed me and started talking about how that bomb ended the war. You didn't really say anything about the horrific things the Japanese did to the Americans. And I, you know, sent her back an email, and we started this dialogue. And by the end of our email exchange, she was like, oh my God, that woman in Hiroshima is just like me. I get it now. And it's that kind of dialogue that really makes me feel like it was all worth it. Yeah, and we live in a culture of violence, and it's just really interesting the responses I get from women. And I get a lot of sometimes very hostile feedback from World War II veterans and, you know, men who are older and of that generation and served in World War II. I'm happy that people even respond, or, you know, they ask questions, whether they agree with me or not, but that at least the dialogue is happening.
Thank you to MT Sylvia, Raising Sand, and News and Views for bringing that interview to my attention and posting it on Radio for All. So just to recap what we've heard on the show, there is an uncomfortable history. These weapons have the possibility to kill all humans on Earth and a large proportion of the rest of life, and yet we're somehow told that they're supposed to make us safer. The people who are in charge of these weapons and the institutions have a track record of lying, specifically of lying about the safety of these weapons. They've shown a callous disregard and no integrity as far as keeping promises. Well, that's nuclear weapons, nuclear power, pretty much the same deal, because it's the same bunch of people and the same institutions, more or less. And Chris Busby reports that the epidemiological data on cancer rates near nuclear power stations is now off limit. So if it's been collected, it shouldn't be given out to ordinary men and women. Is this the Nuclear Safety Agency who have decided this? I'm reminded of the fact that in Fukushima, their way of dealing with all the alarming radiation statistics was to turn off the alarms, simply redefine the acceptable legal maximum dose. Hey presto, problem solved. As David Graeber noted, the problem of bribery in the US political system dealt with by making it legal. Call it lobbying, now it's a valid industry. So fundamentally the question is, do we trust the guys in charge? And yeah, there's different hierarchies. Sometimes they're competing, sometimes they're working together. But when you think at things like, well, was Iraq invaded based on a lie? Did they use radiological weapons there? Yeah, they used depleted uranium. Nobody's really denying it. Is that legal or is it illegal? Is there any comeback if a man says, for example, I will shut down Guantanamo Bay if you make me president, and then you make him president and then he doesn't do it? Many people are becoming inured to the fact that no, that's just how the world is. Many people are not accepting this, so hats off to Occupy. And we've heard from activists such as Angie Zelter about breaking in and destroying military hardware. Well, has anybody attempted to make a moral case for using nuclear weapons? I don't know of any legal statutes which permit the killing of millions of people you've never met and the pollution of the world for millions of years to come. Well, if you need to consult legal statutes to know whether or not it's acceptable to drop nuclear bombs on people, I think your moral framework needs a bit of attention. Likewise, if you think it's acceptable to follow the orders of psychopaths, liars, and known mass murderers because they happen to call themselves president or prime minister, I think that's also worth thinking through. Is there any difference between the supreme international war crime, starting a war of aggression, and the preemptive defensive war, which was started against Iraq, which had no plans to attack its aggressors? These are questions, of course, you won't hear on the commercially controlled media. I would encourage you to ask them to those you know and care about, and promote the understanding that the world is driven by crazed lunatics, and the sooner we take these weapons of mass destruction off them, the better. A lot of people in those institutions maintaining these nuclear weapons are doing so with the best of intentions. Well, these people must have families, and by and large they've got consciences too. Is it morally defensible to work in a nuclear weapons silo? Remembering David Graeber, if you're put in a position of debt, that's a good way of abridging that thought, of saying, look, I have to make a living somehow, this is how I'm doing it, end of story. My vision of the world is something akin to a citizen's income, where people are given, not necessarily by an all-powerful government, but people are given what they need, and this is why I keep urging people whom I meet to give all they can. I think that through generosity, we see an abundance, not only on a material, but also on a deeper level. I think this is how human beings, for most of history, have liked to behave, and I think it's how most of us long to behave in our heart of hearts. And we're going to close the show with a few brief excerpts from Original Child Bomb. Thank you to Vincent, who's a listener of the show, for bringing this to my attention. It was produced by him and Chaz Kay. This is an audio production based on a poem written by Thomas Merton, whose thoughts we first touched on in episode 517. And this is a collection of excerpts. The full audio is available from our webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/616.
Points for meditation to be scratched on the walls of a cave. 1. In the year 1945, an original child was born. The name Original Child was given to it by the Japanese people, who recognized that it was the first of its kind. 12. On July the 7th, the Emperor of Japan pleaded with the Soviet government to act as mediator for peace between Japan and the Allies. 19. On this same day, 60 atomic scientists who knew of the test signed a petition that the bomb should not be used against Japan without a convincing warning and an opportunity to surrender. At this time, the USS Indianapolis, which had left San Francisco on the 18th of July, was sailing towards the island of Tinian with some uranium-235 in a lead bucket. The fissionable material was about the size of a softball, but there was enough for one atomic bomb. Instructions were that if the ship sank, the uranium was to be saved first, before any life. 25. August 5th was a Sunday, but there was little time for formal worship. They said a quick prayer that the war might end very soon. On that day, Colonel Tibbetts, who was in command of the B-29 that was to drop the bomb, felt that his bomber ought to have a name. He baptized it Enola Gay, after his mother in Iowa. Colonel Tibbetts was a well-balanced man and not sentimental. He didn't have a nervous breakdown after the bombing, like some of the other members of the crew.
This and all previous episodes are available to download from our archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Keep giving all you can. If you're concerned about the so-called financial crisis, I'd encourage you to have a look at the nuclear weapons industry, nuclear power. Is that possibly a lot more urgent, as far as priorities go, something that, if we can clear off the face of the earth, our descendants will thank us for.
They'll take your money.